The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
He may be lost in his own matrix of ideas and worldview and textbook knowledge and unable to see the world in any other way except on the basis of the assumption that he has. But the academic is applying a philosophy of maximal control. The market practitioner, Jim Grant, is applying a philosophy of maximal freedom. And there is the reason I like to spend time with Grant.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, you're back, and I always enjoy it when you've had a trip to New York and you've had time to spend with Jim Grant and whatever the gang is of economists and experts that he gathers every year, or actually twice a year, isn't it, for the Grants Conference.
And this was a unique opportunity because on the one hand, I went for the Grants Conference. Jim's been writing the Interest Rate Observer for decades, and my dad read him, I read him, and we continue to learn lots from him and from his guests at the conference. But there was another aspect which was interesting this year. Gratitude and thanks to Bob and to Lily and Michelle and Jeffrey and Derek. And I was hosted for a day and got to meet with a couple of different groups there in Manhattan. And it was absolutely fantastic.
You were treated like royalty from what I understand. I mean, from morning to night, it sounds like there was something planned and it was always good.
Yep. So I was asked to do two different seminars and just it was amazing hospitality. And I think I discovered a community of friends quite unexpectedly. So thank you so much for that. Bob, Lily, Jeffrey, Michelle, and Derek, thank you so much.
Well, you know, I have to look at this from an aspect of what do we learn when you get back? Because oftentimes, and I went to a conference a couple of weeks ago that I'm still going back and reviewing. When you go to a conference and you have a high intensity stream of information coming at you from people who really should know what they're talking about, you can't gather it all at once. You have to sit down and say, okay, what was just now said? And one of the best things that you can do is talk to someone else who was at the conference. And so what I'd like to do, Dave, so that we can maximize this, and you know, we should just say right now, I mean, this is a conference that's several thousand dollars to go to. If a person who is interested in economics has never been to Grants, they ought to go. But if you don't, or even if you did, make sure that you go through and debrief afterwards.
He has an online option where you don't have to go to New York. You don't have to be at the Plaza Hotel. You can access all of the speaking by video. And I've thought of doing that, but honestly, things crop up. And so it actually is worth my time and the effort to get there, be there, sit there, take notes, interact directly with the speakers, have lunch and eat with them, talk with them, and hash through particular issues.
Well, and these are decision makers. You know, oftentimes we're asked, well, why don't you just stick with, you know, whatever your philosophy is? Why don't you just talk more about your philosophy? The problem is, the people who are making decisions don't always agree with your philosophy. And for you to be able to make good decisions, you have to know what they're thinking. You know, whether it's a Mario Draghi or an Otmar Issing, or in this case, a Dudley, who's been president of the New York Fed, you may not agree with everything he says, but you better listen to what he's thinking.
Yeah, Jim Grant's Interest Rate Observer today reads more like a human interest story than even just a financial markets analysis. It includes that, but he's looking for the actor behind the scenes.
Well, didn't he debate Bill Dudley right there at the conference?
Yeah, exactly. And Jim was earnestly protesting in the debate with Bill Dudley that these are heartbeats. These are people that are impacted.
Not just numbers.
That's right. It's not the artificial manipulation of interest rates, which is the only issue. It's the people behind it. Mm. Not merely a figure, it's a measure of time. These interest rates are a measure of time. They're a calculation of value. They're inputs that end up determining the hopes and dreams of people that have anticipated their income needs at a future date.
Right.
So the prudent have foreseen a day when they would need a supplement to income as they age and energy levels slow, and they take the bottled up energy, the storing of energy, if you will, through the years, and apply it in a future moment. That's really what savings are for, is being able to reapply your energy and that value stored through the years when you need it most, when frankly, stress and strain are not as easily borne.
I remember the first macroeconomics class that I took. I really had no idea what I was taking, and it sounded incredibly boring. And I opened up the book, and I saw at the beginning of the book, careers in economics. And I was like, careers in economics? Gosh, I'm only taking this class because I have to. Now, it was because I was ignorant that economics, the heartbeats, the time, the blood, sweat, and tears of the world, that's economics. And last night when we were talking, it really hit me, Dave. You were a philosophy major because you cared about the way people think. You care about what's going on with this enterprise called human. And economics is philosophy with teeth. I mean, it's how energy is stored and translated.
Well, and I granted, there's different views to economics and different approaches to it. So how you come to the science of economics is unique. It, same thing happened with philosophy, where there is a reshaping of the philosophical dialogue. Go back to the 1920s, and all of a sudden, logical positivism became very popular.
Right.
And at all your colleges were trying to bring some form of science and the scientific method into philosophy. And it started to reshape, even malform, if you will, the world of ideas. And I think the same thing has happened throughout the soft sciences, where they've needed to legitimize themselves according to some mathematical equation. So today, an economist works with DSGE models and is less concerned about human action. And that's where you look at Jim's contribution through the Interest Rate Observer, and it really does tie to those issues of humanity and human action, and where economics is just a tabulation of a score, who's doing what and why. You're getting into the mind of the individual, which is, again, the point of economics, at least in an earlier iteration.
And as we go through these speakers, I'd like our listeners to think that way, because as you debrief me, like you did last night, and I'd like to hear it again, about what these speakers talked about, realize that even economics, okay, if you go to MIT, you're going to learn a certain type of economics. If you go to Berkeley, you're going to learn a certain philosophy of economics. If you're Jim Grant, it's sure. going to be a different philosophy.
Right. So I like to go to New York City once a year. Sometimes it's twice. And it's a mix of individual investors, of institutional investors seeking to better grasp the investment landscape and how they can more effectively engage it. Typically 9 speakers. Jim makes 10th, and he takes the stage, and each of these people share unique perspectives. Mm. And I ran into people that traveled from every state here in the U.S. and from as far as Australia and Hong Kong and Pakistan and England and Uruguay and Brazil and Japan and Austria and Switzerland. And it, you know, particularly the Swiss, I think it's curious there. Those from Switzerland seem to have a particularly earnest look on their face.
When I went to Switzerland with you, I had heard that you could eat off the floors of the airport and the train stations, and that the trains ran on time.
Well, in this
case, gnomes of Switzerland, they truly are earnest about those things.
Well, in this case, anyone looking for interest rates in the land of the gnomes is probably more of an archaeologist than a market practitioner, investor, or economist.
Are you referring to the negative rates that you can get for long-term bonds in Switzerland?
That's right. Subterranean and going out 50 years in maturity. So that the conversations are always fascinating at the coffee breaks. They're lively. The presentations are thoughtful. Oftentimes they're challenging. And occasionally there is a perspective shift where something is said or said a certain way that plants an idea or confronts a fallacy, which more than makes up for the price of admission.
Well, and we've had guests, actually a number of guests that you've met at the Grants Conference that have ultimately come on to the show. But before you ever even get there, you know, you are training for triathlon, but you know, your habit is to put some running shoes on and hit Central Park.
Yep. I start every morning in New York City with a tall glass of water at your recommendation, usually more than one, and my running shoes. And that, you know, right now you've got the leaves changing in Central Park, and it's glorious. It extends the autumn season by a few weeks. I'm in week 4 of a new training cycle. And here in Colorado, we've already turned towards the winter months. So
yeah, we got a little dusting.
Seeing a little color in the East Coast is something I love. Running Central Park is always entertaining to me. I look at people. I watch people. I ask questions. Who are they? Hmm. Leaving the brownstone, leaving the flat, leaving the one-bedroom studio, saying goodbye to the night and good morning before the sun's even up. You know, who has 8 dogs in this town?
Right.
You see somebody walking, and it's just like this mishmash of dogs. And of course, that is a profession in Manhattan, being a dog walker.
You know, my daughter lived in Manhattan for several years, and getting a chance to go, and you go more often than I do. I think about it. You know, when you look at a map of New York from above, you look at that swath that they call Central Park, and you think that real estate would have been very, very, very valuable by now if you would have let them build buildings on it. What foresight hundreds of years ago did they have when they planned the city to have that park? Otherwise, can you imagine if it was just a concrete city and that was all you had?
There is a temptation for me to eat large when I'm in Manhattan because food is an attraction there. but the only other real attraction for me in Manhattan is that empty open space.
Yeah.
Central Park is, if I have free time, you will find me at Central Park.
But you do transition from Central Park.
Of
you
course,
actually go back to
coffee and a suit,
yeah,
and, you know, then sitting down to sort of, what we started with was the sobering economic observations of the first speaker at Grants, David Rosenberg.
Mm.
He was at Merrill as their North American chief economist forever, and then moved on to Gluskin Sheff. And he concluded that a significant rise in the price of gold in future years would probably have him changing his name from Rosenberg to Goldberg. but before that, he made the case, as we have here on the commentary, that we're in a long-term economic war. This is not simply a trade conflict with the Chinese. And so even coming to certain conclusions, phase one, phase two, however many phases there end up being, there is a backdrop issue here. He pointed also to the uncertainty index compiled by Haver Analytics. It's at the highest level it's been at since 1997.
Hmm.
You've got Brexit. You've got a weak coalition government in Italy and in Israel and in Canada. You've got impeachment proceedings here in the U.S. and the trade issues, which linger on well past phase one agreements.
Yeah, but what about phase one? I mean, we have a trade agreement, do we not?
I love Stephen Roach's comments here in recent weeks saying basically you can't solve a multilateral issue on a bilateral basis. So if China and America do come to an agreement, it misses the point, which is the imbalances from an economic and trade perspective are multilateral. So it's the wrong way to approach it from, it just doesn't even fit the right framework. But Rosenberg also pointed out that the leading economic indicators are currently the lowest since 2009. They're down 20 consecutive months with the OECD member countries. That's the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. Those member countries, 20 months in a row of declines. And in the U.S., 16 months of decline in the leading economic indicators.
Well, I wonder when that turns into a recession, because we're 123 months into what they call an expansion, yet QE's been reintroduced, the repo situation, we don't have to go there again.
Well, and he said, basically, as good as it's gotten, you know, it's kind of further evidence of tougher times ahead, the output gap, measuring aggregate supply and aggregate demand in this particular cycle, the gap never closed. And it's the first time in U.S. financial history that the gap has remained open in a recovery cycle.
So is it really a recovery cycle?
He's saying this time has elements of being different. So in a period of disinflation, which he believes is immediately ahead of us, of course, if the gap never closed and things do get worse, then you've got the gap widening further.
Now, that's, didn't John Maynard Keynes say that you could just always push demand? I mean, isn't that the idea? Just make sure that demand continues to happen?
That was a focus of Keynesian economics, is actually sort of the moral obligation to prop up aggregate demand.
Mm.
And so that looks at one side of the equation, right? The gap is made up of two sides. Go back in history, you've got in the 1500s, we had a supply side deflation. The 1930s is the one that everyone's afraid of. It was a demand side deflation. And now Mr. Rosenberg believes that we're going to have both supply and demand side deflation.
Okay, but deflation, okay. So where is inflation right now as far as what he's thinking?
Well, again, you know, like the output gap, which never closed, that being an oddity in history, this, in terms of the core CPI, consumer price index, the fact that it's peaked at 2.4%, that is the lowest peak in a recovery cycle since the 1930s. So his expectation is that rates, interest rates, go negative in nominal terms here in the United States, and that, again, inflation, which has been hard for them to boost and get higher, in fact, goes from disinflation to outright deflation. So soft landings, how does he arrive at the conclusion that interest rates are going negative? Because soft landings have always had three interest rate cuts. And if it's worse than a soft landing, if you have a recession, the minimum shrinkage in rates is 2%.
Okay.
So 200 basis points. But typically,
that would take us to zero at this point, wouldn't it?
And typically it's 5% or 500 basis points of cuts. So yes, where does that take us to? The new class in interest rates is going to be called interest rates for archaeologists.
Yeah, negative. Negative under the ground.
Subterranean and for the historical only. So you've got negative nominal yields, which he believes are coming here in the United States. That's us catching down to the rest of the world. And he observed that the transportation average, not the Dow Jones Industrial Index, but the Dow Jones Transportation Average, it peaked in September of 2018.
And so we're a year past that peak.
Yep. The small cap Russell 2000 peaked in August of 2018. And there was an interesting article, which I'm sure folks saw in the Wall Street Journal not long ago. This was just last week. James McIntosh wrote The Stealthy Bear Stalking the Dow. And he, too, makes the point that we're probably going to backdate the recession and the bear market to we're already there. And he makes the case. I know this sounds counterintuitive. How can we already be in a bear market? We're not down 20% in the indexes. And again, look at McIntosh in the Wall Street Journal, The Stealthy Bear Stalking the Dow. It's an interesting article.
Well, another signal that we've talked about for recession is an inverted yield curve. And we've talked about how the Fed has influenced that yield curve in a way where they're controlling it to take that signal away.
And as recently as 12 months ago, the San Francisco Fed was doing research and affirming the predictability of the yield curve, the usefulness of the yield curve as an indicator in terms of recession ahead. So what I'm saying is that when it inverts, you're already on the cusp of recession. And he reminded the audience that when you see the Fed activity, like we saw in 2018, fourth quarter in particular, with Powell tightening and raising rates, 10 of the last 13 tightening cycles ended in recession. Not immediately. It's not like, oh, well, that he raised rates one time too many. Here we are in recession. It's generally with a 10 to 18 month lag.
Okay, so we're looking election year, 2020.
But do the math. 10 of 13 means that basically the odds of a 2020 recession are 80%. And we're in that lag phase where no one is concerned. And the current rate cuts, people are excited by, you know, today's actions. You know, we've got rates being announced by the Fed today, forgetting what is already baked into the cake because of the tightening cycle, which is now almost a year ago.
Okay, so a flat yield curve is different than when we have steep angles. There are opportunities built in. If you're a money manager, you're going to look at the angle of the yield curve.
That's right. And so with a flat yield curve, you essentially have return-free risk, to quote Paul Isaacs. I got to sit next to Paul, and we had some interesting conversations.
So you're getting no return, but you're taking risk. And that's what we've been trying to convince our listeners we're in right now.
Right. So when you have, again, he also reflected on the yield curve signaling of maximum opportunity. So you have basically zero opportunity, but lots of risk with a flat yield curve. You start to steepen the yield curve. And when it reaches its maximum steepness, that is a time and place where you want to be adding risk to your portfolio. You want to be buying everything you possibly can because now you do have great potential for returns.
And that's when nobody wants to buy something like that.
Correct, correct. So the opposite is true today. We should be de-risking. He likes government bonds. He likes volatility. He likes dividends. He likes cash. He likes gold.
What do you mean by volatility? Okay, government bonds, volatility. You said what? Dividends,
yes,
cash, and of course gold.
If you wanted to pick on one thing, you could look at the VIX and say, okay, well, the VIX as a measure of volatility is now under 13. To be able to play that volatility while it's low, you begin to see volatility in the stock market, and that 13 can move to 50 in about 2 seconds.
So it's betting on the volatility increasing when it gets real low.
That's right. And he would say, so it's calm before the storm. It's as good as it gets. In fact, one of the funny things that he said, it was kind of a joke between the optimist and the pessimist. The optimist says, things can't possibly get any better. And the pessimist says, I think you're right. And that really is what captures Rosenberg's commentary and comments for his presentation. I think you're right. it's not going to get any better. So it reminded me, looking at the allocations, he was really focused on reliable cash flows. Mm. And, you know, we are now in earnings season, the thick of it. Lila Murphy on our wealth management team is listening to countless earnings calls. And, you know, she's a great addition to our wealth management team. One of our favorite companies that we follow and she looks at in detail increased its dividend again. Mm. It's the 25th year in a row of dividend increases.
Well, and how often can you get safe income these days? I mean, safer income. There's nothing completely safe, but safer income.
Right. There's risk in everything that you do. But I took from Rosie's presentation, some that's what he's affectionately known as, Rosenberg, Dave Rosenberg. Mm. So I took from his presentation, and soon to be Goldie instead of Rosie, I suppose, that safe income is very scarce. Safe income is very scarce, and you should own as much of it as you can. And that happens to be the core emphasis of our most popular account style at MWM. Reliable cash flows translating into well-protected dividends. So anyways, the Rosenberg comments were interesting. They had a particular tone, kind of a deflationist tone. The next presentation was Ann Dias. And she used to be a Soros fund portfolio manager. Now she runs her own shop. Mm. Here's a few key takeaways. First, that inflation is structurally lower, and the official central bank targets are not being hit, in part due to what she describes as the fourth industrial revolution.
Yeah, I remember talking to you about that last night, and that is so profound. I mean, if you really look at the 20th century, Dave, and going into the 21st century, we should all be on top of the world as far as us making bills and the ease or the cost of everything, because transportation, everything's affected by technology, artificial intelligence, and, you know, just the internet. But if you really look at what's gone on, people are having a harder and harder time making their bills. That money's being funneled somewhere. We're not getting the deflation that we should have all enjoyed of the 20th and the 21st century.
Yeah, and there's aspects of Anne's presentation that I really liked, found helpful, and then there's some missing gaps too. And the cloud and Internet of Things and machine learning and big data and AI and digital money and the sharing economy, all of those are themes that are expressed by her succinctly as the tech revolution or the fourth industrial revolution. So what came before it was steam, number one, electricity, number two, computing, number three. These are your revolutions. And now tech, which is leading to a better match between supply and demand, less waste and less excess production. And for the consumer, more bang for the buck. And so she referenced the current reading of the Billion Prices Project.
You've talked about that before.
Yeah, exactly. In the show, we have. And at times in the past, it has read much higher than either the PCE or the CPI, two measures of inflation. But the Billion Prices Project currently reads at -1% for your offline aggregated prices. And because so many things have moved online into the digital platforms, they now have two measures, the offline aggregated prices and the online. The online's -3% for online prices. She's making the case that it is these technological shifts that are making central bank inflation objectives impossible to reach. And I might add, my personal opinion, that's not the whole banana there. This is deflationary effects of having too much debt in the system. That's also a very, very big deal. I would argue maybe even the bigger of the two, but it was still a very helpful insight to consider the sort of fourth revolution or technological industrial revolution. I agree with her that the next policy choice will be to implement fiscal initiatives.
Right. In other words, reasons to spend money. Building projects is what you're talking about.
Yeah, and that'll be in an attempt to bump up to that 2% inflation target. She also observed that central banks are likely to shift the target higher. And, you know, that's just so that they can hit the old target. You aim for 4 in order to hit 2. If you've aimed for 2 and you can't get there, then you start targeting a much higher inflation level. And, you know, of course, I'm sitting there waiting for the exchange with Bill Dudley and Jim Grant for them to take the stage. And I want to hear him reconcile that, you know, the mandate, the Fed mandate of price stability at the Fed, which is one of the stated reasons for their existence. How do you reconcile price stability, currency stability, with any form of inflation targeting, right? But I'll get to Dudley in a minute. I can't possibly get to all nine presentations in our podcast today. So what I'm going to do is just mention at least a quip or a quote or a key takeaway from the rest of them, just to give you an idea of some of the things that stood out. Seth Klarman is from Baupost Group, and he takes the stage with Jim. He's a hedge fund guy.
So he's a practitioner.
Very much so. 37
yeah,
years.
Not just an academic.
Jim starts by saying there's A students who become professors. There's B students who become lawyers. And the C students end up endowing the buildings. I'd like to introduce you to our favorite C student, Seth Klarman, who built a rather large building there on the Harvard campus.
So he got a C, but he built the building.
And he probably got A's, to be honest. But whatever. So, yes, the Baupost Group with its 2% annual fee and 20% performance fee bonus, that model over 37 years has built a very significant personal fortune. And one of the first things to come up in conversation is there a bubble? And is it an everything bubble?
Right. Well, The Economist magazine called it the everything bubble, what was that, 9 months ago?
And Seth said no. He said, not everything's a bubble, but everything is now correlated.
Everything that goes up will go down at the same time.
And so everything is moving up at the same time, and everything is moving down, theoretically, would at the same time if that correlation holds. And as he describes the Baupost mode of operation, in some sense, it reminded me of what we do on our wealth management team. Because he says he worries from the top down and invests from the bottom up.
Right.
And that's exactly the structure we have with sort of a macroeconomic overlay with Doug Noland.
Doug and you, and then Lila from the bottom up.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, marrying macroeconomic insights to micro company specific analysis, you get to find the needle in the haystack opportunity and still maintain that healthy risk awareness. So one of the observations that Klarman was making was, not my opinion, not particularly rocket science, but $12 to $17 trillion in negative nominal yields in the bond market, that's got to be a credit bubble.
Right.
And
right.
I agree.
Well, you brought up debt earlier. I mean, the deflation that we're experiencing isn't just technology driving prices down.
Right. So there's not an everything bubble, but there definitely is a credit bubble.
Right.
And here's where I would back up and say, yes, Seth, but if you have a credit bubble, don't you end up having a nearly everything bubble? So what is cheap? If you're a value investor and looking for something that's undervalued, how many things are undervalued? Maybe we go back to Rosenberg's comments. Maybe volatility is undervalued.
Mm.
You know, maybe there are things that are cheap, but you're not thinking about them from, you know, an operating perspective, a business that you could own and it's priced well. It's just a speculation, which happens to be overlooked and ignored. And so maybe in that sense, there's not an everything bubble. But Jim Grant asked him about all the money that's supposed to be on the sidelines, ready to come into the markets and off of the private equity sidelines, money that's just been piling up in cash and is going to go into mergers and acquisitions. And
okay, yeah, but the last 3 or 4 weeks, we've been talking about a lack of liquidity, the repo markets having to flood billions into the market. Now we have QE again, $60 billion a month. So where is all this money that's piling up on the sidelines?
Well, it's investor liquidity looking for an opportunity. And his point was, all right, so you count $2 trillion, which may be on the sidelines. Do you understand the nature of liquidity? It's there 1 minute and it's gone the next. Just because it is on the sidelines does not mean that it has to necessarily go into the markets. It can just as easily scatter to the winds. And so don't count on dry powder in that sense. Investors can make it disappear instantly under stressful circumstances. So he had a great observation on the TIPS market, Treasury inflation protected securities. And again, this is kind of something that you might expect from a hedge fund guy. Why would you ever buy something where you know who is on the other side of the trade and they're not trustworthy?
Yeah, so the Treasury not only tells you what inflation is and what they're going to pay you on those tips, but they're the guys who, you know, they benefit by lower inflation.
Yeah, so who's on the other side of the trade? A, they're not trustworthy. B, they get to count the inflation stats.
Right.
He said, why would you ever do that?
Well, it's like retirement with Social Security. I mean, the government's basically telling you, oh, no inflation this year, which, you know, maybe that plays out, but cost of living continue to go up.
Skinny cost of living adjustment. So what he was suggesting, what Seth Klarman was suggesting, is kind of the opposite of Rosenberg. So again, I like the back and forth between the presenters. Don't be surprised by a sudden uptick in inflation. and a break in the credit markets, where rates that here recently might have been 1 or 2%, that's what they are presently, can overnight be at 4%. Mm. And again, these are kind of things that you might expect from a macro-oriented hedge fund manager. And one of the things he pointed out too, just last point, is that managing money, today it's becoming very in vogue to use quantitative analysis.
Right, and stochastic numbers, what have you.
And so big data factors in. And he said still the success in investing ties to big judgment, right, not big data.
In other words, you still need the human. Now, you mentioned something a little bit earlier, and I think it would be worth explaining. There is a massive amount of money going into something called private equity, and they're actually bundling up private equity a little bit like bad mortgages back in the mid-2000s. Explain private equity and what's going on there.
Yeah. I mean, we look at the public markets, which is, you know, stocks and bonds that you can buy with the click of a mouse at your broker, online, whatever. And so there's buying and selling in the public markets all day long using CUSIPs and ticker symbols. The private markets are where you have smaller businesses. These would be markets that fit the micro cap or small cap categories, under 400 million, under 180 million. So in that sense, smaller businesses relative to a company that may be worth billions or tens of billions.
Well, and you gave an example to me, a little bit like the dental field. At this point, you've got dentist offices being purchased up all around America.
Yep.
And being turned into more of a franchise than it is a particular, home run business.
Exactly. So these mom and pops are being all rolled up. And that's a theme of private equity, is to just basically aggregate an entire industry. And they're taking investor dollars and they're basically saying, look, we're bankers. We can do a better job than a business operator because we're sophisticated and we got an MBA and we know how to engineer things. What they're really saying is they're good at engineering leverage. And they're good at taking an asset that has a return and adding leverage to it and then trying to extract extra value for themselves from that. So Dan Rasmussen talked about private equity. And to sum it up, he laid out a compelling case that institutional investors are moving en masse to private equity at the worst possible time, and based on a set of assumptions about returns and inherent risks that are just wrong. They're wrong. And so a study by Cambridge Associates shows PE, that is private equity, outperforming the markets by 6% a year. And everybody's like, well, sign me up. That's what I want. You know, Swenson at Yale, this is why he's such a proponent for having endowment assets and something that's a little less liquid, but a lot greater returns.
So they outperformed by 6%, but what was the time period that they were looking at?
That was from 1980 to 2006.
Okay, so that was past tense.
The same Cambridge Associates study shows that post-2006, that category, private equities, has been primarily loser, almost consistently every year. That is in part because you've got 50 times more private equity firms, literally 50 times more private equity firms today trying to do deals than there were 15 years ago. The hedge fund industries suffered from the same kind of dilutive effect because, you know, you go back to the 1980s and you had roughly 500 hedge funds. Today, you've got just shy of 10,000, call it 8,500 roughly. And so again, it's a lot more people trying to chase something unique and different in the marketplace, and returns suffer. So also, this is, I think, a significant point that bankers do believe that they can run businesses better than business operators. And I would put that as one of the primary fallacies within the private equity area. Well, just because you know how to count beans doesn't mean you know how to make a product or run logistics or do R&D or even organize people and get those people to do what they do best.
One of the things that bankers also do is once they have a business, they know how to leverage it because they can, at that point, go multiples of what the business is actually worth.
And that is where they really are talented. Bankers do apply leverage to balance sheets to increase internal rates of return. And his conclusion, that is Dan Rasmussen's conclusion, critically, was that these are very highly leveraged. At this point, private equity is highly leveraged, very expensive. The credit quality has slipped. It's at the lowest rung. It's very illiquid. And you're dealing with opaque investments that are popular due primarily to that legacy performance, 1980 to 2006. And now you've got institutional investors that are ignoring the risks and will continue to do so because the pricing of the assets in the models used don't have to be marked to market.
Do you remember 10 years ago how we started hearing that? Market price was something that we all just assumed until about 10 years ago, but then we started hearing mark to model.
Let's say I run a portfolio and I want 10% or 20% of the portfolio in private equity. This becomes a 10 to 20% black hole where essentially I'm not going to get any market pricing for it. So I'm going to have to come up for the sake of my statement.
We'll just call it this price.
We're going to call it our cost, or we're going to call it, yeah, let's assume that it's appreciated by 7% a year. Or, I mean, there's going to be assumptions in the modeling of the valuation, but there is no market price for privately traded companies on a monthly basis, weekly basis, real-time basis. And so there's a lot of room for positive thinking.
Well, and the problem with that, too, is how liquid is that asset?
Not very. And so you've got, with a lot of these structures, the holding periods for the companies that they're buying, restructuring, trying to roll out and resell or even take public again to extract more value, the holding periods are now longer than ever.
Right.
You've got bad investments that are not being acknowledged. In many cases, the bad investments get restructured into a new product offering.
Boy, does that sound familiar. Yeah, you restructure it. This is one thing bankers can do, too. It's like, ooh, there's some bad investments
here.
Let's
move that from portfolio A to portfolio B. Report on portfolio A, which shows impeccable performance. And so I'm as I listen to Dan, I had every one of my concerns about private equity confirmed. And he could have been talking about Enron, frankly, because here you've got private equity, which is a Wall Street favorite today. And you go back to that period where Enron was a Wall Street favorite and it was the master at presenting phony happiness.
Right.
And that's what Dan describes as sort of this endemic feeling. Everybody wants private equity because it presents this sort of phony happiness. Your returns are above the market, at least as we mark to model, not mark to market. But when he's talking to pensions, when he's talking to endowments and family offices and a host of other institutional investors, they will universally tell him that their private equity managers are in the top quartile. So everybody believes they have the top quartile performers. So there's some people, yeah, this applies to, they're doing some crazy stuff and it's way over leveraged and it's really low quality credit, but not ours. We're dealing with the top quartile managers. 100% of people believe they're working with the top 25%. How does that work exactly? Right?
Yeah, 70% of the time it works every time.
Yeah,
right?
But they also believe, in addition to the top quartile, that they don't have liquidity issues because these are very sellable companies and there's no credit concerns within these structures. So everybody believe they're picking the winner. And this is kind of how he did this mass survey. 94% of the institutional investors that he surveyed believed that they would outperform equities, that their private equity holdings would outperform equities. 94% believe that. 76% believed the credits that they were investing in were double B or better. So Mr. Rasmussen takes that whole portfolio and has it looked at by Moody's. Moody's reviews the same private equity credits. And remember, the institutional investors said 76% believe we're BB or above.
Right, right.
Moody's says 98% of the paper you just put in front of us is BB or below. So we're dealing with junk credit.
Right.
And you don't know how to read your credit risk is what they're saying to the institutional investors. So underestimation of risk is that a recipe for success or is that a recipe for disaster?
Well, and then you had mentioned that right now everything's correlated. If that's really true, everything that's rising right now will fall at the same time. People don't buy when things are falling. Where's the liquidity?
Yeah, so back to Klarman's observation about correlation, the greatest correlated belief of the last 25 years is that private equity is the best place to be. Again, you've got Swenson at Yale, that endowment, and he's made the case that it's a better form of capitalism. And that might have been the case for the early adopters. Again, go back to 1980. If that's when you got started, or even the 1990s, great. But what about now?
Yeah.
No more.
Remember, last week, it was either last week or the week before, we were talking about your past brokerage experience where when Wall Street wants to sell something, they're going to make it sound like it's the greatest thing.
Right. So you've got a sizzling Wall Street sales pitch. And I think that's largely why institutional investors, endowments, pensions are moving towards private equity. Let me ask you a question. Would Wall Street promote a loser? if the fees were well above average. Mm. Let's say, for instance, your all-in fees were 6% a year. Per year.
Oh, they wouldn't do that. No, they're always looking out for the client.
Would you be interested in promoting a loser if it paid you 6% a year? Now, it's 3% if you're not including carried interest. So between 3 and 6%, depending on how you calculate carried interest. You tell me. So here's where you've got disaster embedded in the private equity markets. It's tied to a consensus view, which it's the best place to be.
Right.
Leverage, which continues to ratchet higher with basically small cap companies, and illiquidity. You've got a structure which doesn't allow for people to get out. And at the end of the day, what do you do if you need to liquidate an asset within your private equity holdings? Who buys it?
Right.
Premiums or discounts? Because the exit strategy for most private equity guys is to take it, repackage it back to the public markets and sell it to the public market sucker at a premium based on numbers they won't understand, dependent entirely on the boost from leverage, not realizing that it's not sustainable. And actually, you're going to end up having to pay for that debt accumulation. And it may actually sacrifice the business itself.
Every once in a while, you'll see something and you'll go, you know, that should be a bumper sticker. I need to remember this for the rest of my life. And actually, you just said it, Dave. There are three things that a person needs to write down. If they're driving, memorize this. But when you have consensus, leverage, and illiquidity, the very next thing that comes at some point is the crash.
Oops.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, only two more. I promise. I can't possibly go through all nine. But Peter Ciappianelli was from GMO. That's Jeremy Grantham's group. And it was fantastic. Mm. His whole presentation was on bond indexes. And that may not sound like a very interesting lead-in, but it was arguably the most important presentation. Because first, his target for critique was the Barclays Aggregate Bond Index. There are a number of other indices for bonds, but this is one of the big ones. And what is the importance here? Well, in an age of passive investing, this gives you, I think, a very clear picture on how malinvestment and continuations of that theme of malinvestment is on autopilot because of the structure of the indexes and the way these things work.
And we've talked about this. Passive investing is part of this consensus that we talked about before. Consensus, leverage, and illiquidity. When you have passive investing where everyone is going just into indexes because everybody else is going into indexes, you don't realize there's the other side of the market that never appears until the repricing.
Well, and at least with this, you've got two of the three. Consensus, which is definitely you want to be in indexes because it's a cheaper way to invest. And the third of those three, illiquidity, yeah. As I think people will find, the fixed income markets are not quite as liquid on the way out as they seemed to be on the way in. So in this context, the Barclays Aggregate Index, there's no judgment calls or analysis. Once an asset is listed in the index, the buying of that asset is automatic. And frankly, if we ever see selling, selling is automatic too. So you see sort of a radical volume increase, driving prices higher, and arguably you could see the flip side of that as well. And the quantities of money coming into these funds are astounding. Tens of billions of dollars. Some of these indexes, even hundreds of billions of dollars. So Peter points to certain assets that keep on seeing flows. For instance, Swiss bonds. And you think to yourself, well, you know, if a Swiss bond is yielding negative 1% or negative 95 basis points, nearly 1%, why would you buy it? Oh, did you know that it was in a bond index? And because it's in the bond index, as capital flows into the passive side of the investment universe, which is now the largest growing side of the investment universe, it's an automatic purchase.
Yeah. I was just asked the other day, it's like, well, why would I ever buy a negative paying interest rate bond? And part of the bet is basically saying, well, the only reason you would own a Swiss bond that's negative rate is to speculate that the interest rate is going to go lower.
And there's a fascinating article on that last week in the Financial Times where it talks about bonds trading like stocks and stocks trading like bonds. Mm. You know you're in a mixed up world when people are buying bonds for capital gains and stocks for income. And that's exactly where we live today.
Well, and a stock, however, represents a company. A bond represents debt. How good is this debt that are in these funds?
Well, I mean, this is where, as a student of history, the markets seem irrational for making these purchases of bonds. But the point is that rationality is not in the equation. Rationality is not in the equation. And this is not new on our commentary to talk about the quantities of debt, which the quantities of debt outstanding are pretty high. But the other observation would be about the quality which is rapidly deteriorating. And this was a point that Peter Ciappinelli from GMO made. 10 years ago, 1/3 of the sector was triple B.
Which is junk, right?
No, triple B is the last rung of investment grade.
Okay.
So you're barely hanging on, but that's
not quite
status.
Junk.
That's right.
Okay.
So you are investment grade,
right?
So triple B credit is not that great, but it's not terrible either. You don't have to hold your nose, really. 1/3 of the sector was triple B. That's the lowest investment grade rating. That was 10 years ago. Today, triple B is half of the market. So you've got an increasing amount clustered at the lower rung, on that lower rung. So greater quantities of barely investment grade paper. And today, because of the compression in interest rates, it's paying the least in interest ever.
And I have to ask you, you know, Howard Unstadt, he said the cycle prevails. What's the cycle as far as credit defaults?
This is now the riskiest equation you could possibly have for triple B credit. And he's pointing out, Ciappinelli is pointing out that we've had credit events roughly every 4 to 7 years where you've got a deterioration in that lower quality and it gets kicked into the junk category. So mass deterioration moves debt from one category, triple B, to a lower rung, and now you're categorically, again, this is just one grade lower, and that's the difference between investment grade and junk. Many institutions don't allow junk bonds or high yield bonds, as they're euphemistically called, into their portfolios. It's kind of a big deal. It's kind of a big deal. But capital keeps on flowing into the space. So what are you getting for the money that you're investing? You're getting a smaller and smaller income stream. You're taking higher and higher risk. Oh, and by the way, duration is being stretched out farther and farther and farther for the same paper. So you're taking myriad risks and not getting any reward for it. Again, back to that issue we were talking about earlier of return-free risk. So quantity is one thing, quality is another. On top of those, Peter looks at the corporate sector debts and he says, look, just for a minute, set aside quantity because that's only one aspect. And you can always be surprised on the upside by how much debt gets added to a balance sheet. Compare it to earnings ratios. Look at debt to EBITDA, earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization. And this number, this ratio shrinks in an economic recovery.
Sure. You borrow less if you're recovering.
Well, and as your earnings grow relative to your debt, that ratio ends up looking better, right? And of course, the number expands in a recession where your earnings are shrinking, but the debt does not go away. In fact, sometimes you have to take on more debt just to survive. And his point was this, the ratio of debt to EBITDA is spiking. And we're not in a recession. Debt growth is exceeding earnings growth significantly.
I thought we'd been expanding. I thought we'd been expanding 123 months.
That's the issue. The longest U.S. financial market expansion, and we're already seeing where there's areas, particularly lower rung of investment grade, where the market's turning, right?
Right.
So one of the things that GMO is sort of on the map for, Jeremy Grantham started taking risk off the table in 1999 and 2000. He lost half of his assets under management. His clients fired him because he reduced risk in the portfolio. And they came back later on.
He didn't like what he saw before the bubble popped.
No. And so to do the right thing when you're allocating assets does come with professional risk. And there's very few people on Wall Street who will do the right thing because they fear professional extinction risk, right?
Well, so, it's lonely. It's lonely to be right because most of the time you talked about, remember the three things. Consensus was one of those. If you're not with the consensus, then you're lonely.
When I'm training for triathlon, one of the things that I remind myself is I either pay now or I pay later. I tell the kids this all the time. You either pay now or pay later. You're working hard now or you're working hard later. You either take the risk on the front end of being wrong on your timing or you face a far graver risk, which is your enterprise may be gone in the context of a major market sell-off.
And Grantham basically paid early and saved all the loss later.
And that's what his spokesman was there to say is, oh, we'll pay now. We're taking risk off the table, and you look at the credit markets, and you should be taking risk out of your bond portfolios. You have no idea how it's stacking up, and it's on an automatic basis. You don't want to do this.
But we're talking about people's retirement. I mean, we're talking 401ks, pensions,
well, that's,
what have you.
That's the key, because the index buys massive quantities of bonds. Those purchases are not scrutinized by a credit committee. They're not looked at for credit risk, duration risk, inflation risk, but capital flows into things. Think about this. Does anyone, any of the listening audience, do you have a targeted date fund in your 401k? I want to retire in 2035. So I want some mix of stocks and bonds. It's a 2035 fund. You own the Barclays Aggregate Index.
Right.
You own negative yielding Swiss bonds. You're the sucker. You're the sucker and you have no idea.
This goes back to passive investing. This whole passive investing thing is just basically put a bunch of junk in people's portfolios, calling it good.
Right. So indiscriminate buying today is indiscriminate selling tomorrow. And everybody feels like they're doing such a great job managing that risk by saying, look, I'm not paying any fees. My fees are so low on these index funds.
Mm.
Right. So you're going to save yourself a half a point to a point management fee, and you're willing to risk 20, 30, 40% of the value of your assets. In an old book, I forget what it was called, but I think that's Penny Wise and Pound Foolish.
Mm, mm.
So here we discussed countless times in the commentary sort of the indiscriminate buying today and the potential for that being indiscriminate selling tomorrow. In fixed income, this is the issue. There's no market maker of last resort.
Okay, but Bill Dudley was right there, and the Federal Reserve has been looked at as the final buyer of everything. If there's a problem, they're the buyer of everything. How do we know that the Fed doesn't have our back?
Oh, well, I'm just going to comment on Dudley, and then we'll wrap up today, because Dudley, a part of his debate with Jim Grant, Dudley said emphatically, there are things the Fed cannot legally do. We cannot buy stocks. We cannot buy bonds. This is corporate bonds. And so, you know, keeping Ciappinelli's comments fresh, you have to say the Fed won't buy corporate bonds until they have to, the next crisis, until they ask for permission, right? And then the rules will change, and what was illegal in the last crisis will be front and center, because they'll have to. They'll have to. For those of you who don't know Bill Dudley, he was the 10th president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Like Mario Draghi, goodbye Mario, 48 hours from now, you will be retired from the European Central Bank. We wish you well. Like Mario, Bill Dudley spent a good stint at Goldman Sachs prior to his role as a permanent member of the FOMC and the presidential role, CEO role there.
Well, and a little more recently, Bill Dudley's the guy who said, you know, why wouldn't the Fed possibly consider getting Trump out of office? I know I'm condensing that, but if you remember, about a month ago, he was like, you know, if Trump's not good for the economy, the Fed could certainly do something about it.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Isn't that funny? No. Well, Jim's intro.
Jim Grant, you're talking about.
That's correct.
Yeah.
He included a reference to Bill Dudley's Berkeley PhD in economics. And he had this sort of hilarious reference to the Irish philosopher George Berkeley's immaterialism. He was like, yes, Bill is actually here. And I have to admit, I was the only one in the audience that laughed out loud. But Jim's side of the argument was this. The post-crisis monetary policy is a failure.
Hmm.
The Fed has not done a good job. And
so he's basically insulting Bill Dudley because Bill Dudley was there for the whole thing.
And so Bill Dudley says, no, it was an evident success. We've got the stock market at all-time highs. Bonds are quite stable. Everybody's happy. Jim argues for the price mechanism and the importance of interest rates as a basis of valuation in all assets. Bill Dudley says, look, I was the manager of SOMA during the crisis. And rates are a tool. You may consider them to be a signal, but we consider them to be a tool for managing the economy. Very different perspective, right?
Huge. That's night and day. That's one of our guests called them saltwater versus freshwater. Saltwater is the guy who says, no, 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 this is my tool. I will manage it. You don't need to be here. Freshwater would say, no, 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 we like free markets. We want the signal.
I think that was supposed to be interest in my pocket, not a discount to the debt burden you're trying to subsidize. Difference in perspective. So Bill admitted, this is Bill Dudley, admitted the Fed took some liberties when it interpreted the price stability mandate and then adopting that arbitrary 2% inflation target. And I appreciated the fact that he recognized that there was wiggle room on the interpretation. And I would still say it's a damnable activity. It should not be done. There should not be an inflation target. It runs directly in conflict and contrary to one of two mandates the Fed has, moving us towards fuller employment and maintaining price stability. And by the way, price stability is not asset price stability, which is what they've taken on as a third unofficial mandate.
Controlling the market.
Right. So we can somehow now define price stability and currency stability as we're only picking your pocket 2% a year, but it might be 4% if necessary.
But Jim Grant, the reason you read Grant, the reason you go is because Jim Grant still favors a free market, market pricing. He had to be. I mean, how was he if he's debating Dudley and Dudley's like, everything we're doing is just fine?
Not only is everything we're doing just fine, but even to that 2% inflation target, his argument had sort of marinated in this greater good fantasy, where it's like, oh, no, 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 you don't understand what we're doing for you, but it is for you. And it's just the tone was fascinating. And I think what seemed to set Jim Grant off, I truly believe his temperature went up past the 98.6, never came back, was a comment on the adverse impact of negative rates. And Dudley said, oh, it's a terrible thing. I really don't like it. Such a tax on banks. We just can't stand it. And it was the clearest reminder that a central bank serves banks and banks serve banks. Mm. The saver is, in this equation, the useful idiot putting capital into the system for the intermediation process.
They pay the system to do its own thing.
But over the last 100 years, the transformation or deformation of capital has included the depositor in the bank being disregarded as the most important person in the equation. Why are we here if you're running a restaurant? To entertain ourselves or to serve the customer? When you get onto a plane, are you there to see and test the physics of flying at high altitude in an aluminum projectile? Are you a customer? Are they there to serve you, right? The bankers serve the individual. But this is, I think, what's lost. The savers become the useful idiot. What about the tax on savers? When I look at negative interest rates, I see it impacting the individual. Bill didn't see it. It was a tax on banks. Negative rates are bad for banks. And listen, pragmatically, I can agree with that. The impact of negative rates and a flat yield curve for that entire sector, they can't maintain profitability. You can look at the bank index in Europe, and it's a disaster, right? So yes, negative interest rates do clearly have a negative impact on banks, but the central banker is not asking questions about what's wrong with the equation as it applies to humanity or the individual. It's the banks.
This goes back to philosophy with teeth, okay? Economics is still philosophy. It's liberty or control.
Well, and that's where Jim was clear. These are individuals. These are heartbeats. This is a world where money equals work, equals time, equals those heartbeats. So this is where that clear distinction was, you know, Bill Dudley on the one hand, Jim Grant on the other. Interest rates are the most important price in the financial system. That is a position statement and a philosophical statement from someone like Jim Grant.
Yeah, and that truly is an expression of philosophy. Like you said, we only all have a certain amount of heartbeats. That's scarce. Money printed by the Federal Reserve is not.
Jim, consistent with my own perspective, sees that individuals are valued. Individuals are valued. And we can look at our lives as a measurement of time. We can look at our savings as a reflection of the time and work. What we do has a value.
Right.
And again, this is back to perspective. I'm sure that Bill Dudley is not trying to do wrong. He's trying to do right. We'll just call him Dudley Do Right. So the system of price controls is not offensive to him. He's looking at the impact that it has on a treasury bill much more than he is on what it says about the associated value of time and of work and of savings.
Right.
So stable money, market-driven rates, these are things that reflect real-time value of work. That's either stored labor in the form of savings or labor expended in the present moment, right? So we have two different worlds, preserving on the one hand, and seeing this value as needing to be protected, that's an inherent monetary or fiscal conservatism versus degrading. And degrading is the practical difference between these two men, where for pragmatic reasons, it may make sense to tinker with the numbers.
Well, but when they tinker with the numbers, what we're talking about is adjusting the dials of how much savings you're going to lose to the banking system that they're trying to stabilize.
Right. So the academic is applying a philosophy of maximal control. On the one hand, this is why I came. This is why I go to New York is to see very clearly how people are coming at things. I want to extend as much of an understanding to Bill Dudley as possible and recognize that he may be lost in his own matrix of ideas and worldview and textbook knowledge and unable to see the world in any other way except on the basis of the assumption that he has. But the academic is applying a philosophy of maximal control. Mm-hmm. The market practitioner, Jim Grant, is applying a philosophy of maximal freedom. And there is the reason I like to spend time with Grant.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.